The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. We've got a lot to get to on today's program, quite a few news items that have piled up, and I want to draw your attention to some things that we've been saying as well. And speaking of that, we just received the latest Trumpet magazine in the mail. This would be the May-June issue, May-June 2017, the most powerful weapon. It's not a bomb, it says on the cover. It's an idea. That feature by Andrew Miller talks about some things that Herbert Armstrong, was teaching us many years ago about how that the bombs themselves are not the big problem here. All these weapons, and we'll talk more about weapons and military might here in just a second. But just to touch on what Andrew brings out in the latest Trumpet, the problem is with man. The problem is with human nature. The problem is the fact that Satan has deceived this world. And because of that, we just see history repeating itself. My father's From the Editor piece in this latest Trumpet magazine, by the way, Germany and the last Holy Roman Empire, there's just one more. The last one that's prophesied, and he said in the middle of his piece, despite the barbaric nature of its history, Europe still wants to resurrect the Holy Roman Empire in the tradition of Charlemagne. So beware of what this empire is about to inflict on this world. They want it. They want to see that empire resurrected. Never mind history. Never mind all the destruction that's associated with it. Let's just build it again one last time. Germany and the last Holy Roman Empire. That's in the latest Trumpet, so be on the lookout for that. Of course, we post our Trumpet magazine every month at our website, thetrumpet.com, and there's been quite a lot of activity at the website this week as well. If you haven't visited the website in a couple of days, now would be a good time to do it with all that's going on. Yesterday, we talked to you about the French elections over the weekend. And there's quite a few other news items, as I received here this morning, that are worth commenting on as well. This one here from Forbes, it says, 5 reasons Donald Trump won't reverse the U.S. military's long decline. It talks about how that, you know, when you're campaigning, and it's not just the Republican side. I played for you, I think it was, last week, about all of Donald Trump's assurances on the campaign trail. That he was going to rebuild the Army and the Navy and the Air Force. He was going to rebuild the military. And to this point, he's come out with just a very modest uptick in military spending, and that's assuming that it will even be approved in Congress. But Forbes brings out that it's popular for both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats alike, to talk about how America's military is the best in the world, and we're all supportive of it, and we'll fund it, we'll provide whatever the need is. And yet when you look at the reality, as one commentator after another have been pointing out in recent months, Forbes does it again here today, the Air Force's fleet is the oldest it's ever been. The Navy, something like 80 warships short of what it needs to just maintain the responsibilities it has overseas. It says here the Army's Vice Chief of Staff says his service is outranged, outgunned, and outdated. That's coming from someone in the know. He warns of sending undertrained and poorly equipped soldiers into harm's way. And so America's military is aging. It's in decline. And other nations are catching up. Other nations like Russia, like China, like Iran, like North Korea, like Germany, as we'll see here in just a second. Well, on the campaign trail, Mr. Trump was promising to turn all of this around. But as Forbes brings out here, even the slight uptick in military spending, the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, he told Congress recently that it's not nearly enough. It's not nearly enough to fix the problems. Forbes says, here are the top five reasons why rebuilding America's military is shaping up to be a campaign promise not kept during the Trump era. It's shaping up to be a campaign promise not kept. You'll hear a lot about the campaign promises this week, given that we're coming up to the 100 days, Donald Trump's first 100 days in office, and so his supporters and his critics alike are trying to point out how that he's either been a tremendous success or a tremendous failure. And he's followed through on some of the campaign promises, and others not so much. But this one's critical. And here are five reasons, Forbes brings out, why it's shaping up to be a campaign promise that's not kept. It says here, firstly, decay has been spreading for two decades. I mean, this goes farther back than just the Obama era. I mean, Obama really did take it and drive it into the ground. And we'll get to that in just a second. But Forbes goes back to the collapse of the Soviet Union and how that, happening there in the early part of the 90s, the late 80s, early 90s, just that alone killed all of these major weapons programs that the United States had going on. That was during the first Bush administration and then during the Clinton years. I mean, Mr. Clinton, President Clinton, did little to reverse this trend. And then even on through the 2000s. It says here that George W. Bush took office thinking the world was in a strategic pause, and therefore called for skipping a generation of weapons while the military transformed itself for the digital age. And Forbes says, after the 9/11 attacks occurred, military transformation and investment in cutting-edge technology withered. The terrorists didn't have air forces or navies, so the Pentagon's aging arsenal was adequate to defeat them. We didn't need a lot of new hardware. We didn't need a lot of new ships and planes. We had enough to try to go after these shadowy networks. It says President Obama added his own round of weapons cuts in 2009 and then became embroiled in a fiscal standoff with Republicans that resulted in a law capping military spending for 10 years. And we're still in the midst of that. I think we've got four more years on it. That alone may prevent Donald Trump from any kind of additional funding going toward the Pentagon or toward military spending. It says here that law, speaking of President Obama's law, capping military spending, that law is still in effect. And it has crippled military investment plans. President Trump isn't likely to reverse 20 years of decay and of decay, sorry, in two terms. He's not likely to reverse this. And then the second reason that Forbes puts forth is that the White House can't deliver spending increases. Here again, Congress has to be on board with this. And it's easy to voice support for these kinds of things, but you know what goes on in Congress, the back and forth between Democrats and Republicans. The Democrats saying that for every bit of spending increase that we put toward the military, we've got to also increase the domestic spending. We've got to have parity for defense and domestic spending. If defense goes up, then our programs have to go up as well. And so Democrats are unlikely to sign on with any kind of spending increases. This article also points out the many other priorities that President Trump has. I mean, the promises. Here again, you're going to hear a lot about it this week. The many promises that he's made, not only to the military, but to reform health care. This week, there's much talk about cutting taxes. He's going to rebuild the nation's crumbling infrastructure. And he, like so many others, have promised before him, he's going to do all of this and still keep the deficit under control. Promises, promises. Well, the point that Forbes makes here is that there's all these other priorities, too. It's too much. It's too much. The fourth reason it gives here, that this is a campaign promise that may well not be kept, is that neither party is truly pro-military. They're not in the know. So many of them are just, you know, camped out in their offices in Washington, D.C., and they don't really know the needs, even though you have all of these insiders testifying, like what James Mattis said to Congress. Look, we need more. Or this other one that I quoted from earlier, who said that we're outranged, outgunned, outdated. The fifth reason that Forbes gives here is that the threats have become diverse and confusing. Listen to this. The United States sustained an unusually robust level of peacetime military spending for 40 years during the Cold War because the threat was unambiguous. At one point, the Soviet Union had 10,000 nuclear weapons aimed at America. And Moscow's rhetoric was often bellicose, so support for military preparedness was widespread on Capitol Hill and in the political culture. It isn't like that anymore, Forbes says. It's not like that. Many of the nation's recent overseas interventions have not gone well, and there's a lack of clarity about which dangers should be of greatest concern. Some legislators think that fiscal insolvency or climate change are a bigger danger than military attack. Even among those who grasp the profound dangers of modern warfare, there is doubt as to whether nuclear war or cyber attacks or global terrorism should be the greatest concern. So building political consensus behind a coherent military posture is difficult. See the threats now, they're diverse. They're confusing. They're ambiguous. It's a lot different than it was during the Cold War, when it was obvious the threat was there in the form of those 10,000 nukes aimed at the United States. And Russia constantly repeating the fact that it's going to destroy us. Well, the conclusion here, this is from Forbes magazine. What does all this mean? It means the long decay of the U.S. military, which began amidst the ashes of the Soviet Empire, is likely to persist until something really horrible happens to focus the minds of Americans on the consequences of being unprepared. Well, your Bible says that something horrible is going to happen, and even leaving aside the Bible, you have to wonder, well, if something horrible happened, would it be too late? Would it be too late? Some of these changes that are needed, I mean, they're decades-long changes and improvements. Rebuild the military, that's not something that happens in a couple weeks' time. That's a strong warning coming from Forbes magazine. The status quo is likely to persist until something really horrible happens. You think about Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. Great tribulation. Last week I quoted this piece from Washington Times. Three factors. This is from the Washington Times last week. Three factors have combined to create an emergency in air power. First is the wear and tear imposed by nearly 16 years of combat. Second are with the massive, reckless cuts in defense spending imposed by President Obama, which under the Budget Control Act of 2011 are scheduled to continue for at least 4 years. And then he says, or whoever wrote this, third is the near criminal neglect of our forces by Mr. Obama's generals and admirals. Like I say, these kinds of stories, we're seeing them now almost daily, as many in the military are sounding the alarm. We better do something before it's too late. We better do something before something really horrible happens. Now, you compare this with what's happening in the rest of the world. We've told you a lot about China and Russia and Iran and others. But how about this headline today from the Wall Street Journal? German arms makers go on the offensive, aided by military spending boost. The German defense budget, it's set to rise by 8% this year. And, of course, this is in the Wall Street Journal, so really the whole story here is about, hey, this is great for German businesses. This is great for German industry. This will be good for the economy. No one, and I mean no one, we've made this point before. Even when there was talk about Germany and Europe building a nuclear deterrent, and no one sounds the alarm. No one thinks that's strange. No one even cares. The German arms industry is back in business, it says. Germany's weapons manufacturers, long at the whim of the country's pacifist-leaning politicians, had until recently struggled to find new European orders. They couldn't get any business. Now it's changing, and it's changing fast. But in the wake of Russia's incursions, it says, in Ukraine and its tougher military stance on the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's eastern border, German military spending is rising more than at any time since the Cold War. So you look at what's happened to the United States since the Cold War, and how that it's not easy anymore. I mean, the threats are now diverse and confusing. And nothing, leaving aside 9/11, nothing really horrible has happened. And so our leaders, in so many ways, they've gone to sleep. The leaders in Congress, the leaders in the White House, the leaders in the military even. Save just a few of those voices that are begging for more funding, for better equipment. This article in the Wall Street Journal, though, this is certainly the opposite of what's happening in Germany and elsewhere. It's set to rise 8% this year, the article says. Then it quotes a defense ministry spokesman. This is a welcome change in direction. I mean, this is great. We've got to modernize the Bundeswehr. This is the way to go. This is a good sign of things to come. The journal says Germany, the largest economy in Europe, has so far resisted increasing spending too quickly due to limited public appetite for such a large defense budget. There's a limited appetite for this. But look at what's happening in Europe. Look at how fast things are changing in Europe with all the crises they're facing. And then it adds here, if Mr. Trump puts more pressure on, it'll help the industry, the German defense spending industry, the benefits to German industry. That's what this article is saying. It's pointing out, as we've pointed out, that the Trump administration is actually encouraging this to happen. Military spending, it says, is also rising in NATO countries neighboring Russia, according to Peter Wiesmann, senior researcher. Says this will obviously benefit the German arms industry. And then it says Rheinmetall, that's a German company, is upgrading Leopard tanks for Poland. Lithuania recently bought the Boxer from KMW and Rheinmetall, while Scandinavian countries have placed orders from both companies for upgrades of main battle tanks and new military trucks. Two companies are also finalizing deals in Romania. And so Europe's building an army, or a bigger army, and you pool all the resources together, as I covered last week. This was brought out in that foreign policy piece from a week ago that said, while Europe's ability to project coercive force to compel others to acquiesce to political demands does not match that of the United States. It's more active, Europe is. It's more active and capable than any other global power. That's why you have to see it as one body. That's what the foreign policy said last week. It said that the conventional starting point for measuring military capability is the money each country spends on defense. On this score, the United States, which accounts for more than 40% of global military spending, heads the list. But if we unify European military activities, it comes in second. And now you see Germany taking the lead. German arms makers go on the offensive, aided by military spending boost, a spending boost of 8% this year. These are amazing developments, and of course they factor in to prophecies, many significant Bible prophecies. Leviticus 26, talking about the pride of our power being broken. It says that God has set his face against us. Punishment is coming. The strength that we once had, it's being spent in vain. And meanwhile, like my father covers in the latest issue of the Trumpet magazine, you have the final resurrection of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. Look for that in the latest issue of the Trumpet magazine. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, just send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
In a reciprocal humanitarian gesture, six Iranian Americans and one Iranian serving sentences or awaiting trial in the United States are being granted clemency. These individuals were not charged with terrorism or any violent offenses. They're civilians, and their release is a one-time gesture to Iran, given the unique opportunity offered by this moment and the larger circumstances at play.
That's President Obama from January 17th, 2016. Obviously there he's talking about the Iran nuke deal. And part of it was that prisoner swap, the prisoner exchange, which, as he said there, was just a reciprocal humanitarian gesture. These were just civilians that really hadn't done much of anything. He said it. His spokesman said it. This is from Josh Earnest a few days after the president made that announcement. Clip two.
We made a reciprocal humanitarian gesture by releasing seven individuals, six of whom were U.S. nationals, who had either been tried and convicted of nonviolent crimes, essentially sanctions violations or violations of the trade embargo the United States has in place against Iran.
That's Josh Earnest from January the 19th. Nonviolent crimes, just sanctions violations because of the trade embargo. That's how it was presented right across the board. Here's how Secretary of State John Kerry put it, clip three.
These are people with sanctions violations. So we feel very comfortable that the United States of America held on to its principles, got its people home, kept right. faith with them. There was going to be a lifting of sanctions there, and it made sense for us to link sanctions-related offenses, which were about to expire anyway and be released, to the release of our people who had years ahead of them in jail.
Our people, I think one was a teacher, one was a journalist, one was a former Marine. But in the case of these Iranians, they were American nationals, I think six of the seven, but Iranian-born. They it was because of the trade embargo, sanctions violations. Again, that's how it was presented over and again. Now, a lot has been said in the last year and a half about how that this prisoner swap was made, the plane load of cash, you'll recall, I think $400 million in foreign currencies that had to be there before the Americans were released. But then more is coming out now about these particular individuals that America released from captivity, not just the seven, but 14 others that they were chasing down overseas. They basically just dropped the investigations on those 14. Politico had an in-depth piece yesterday, Josh Meyer at Politico, usually a pretty left-leaning publication. But in this case, a pretty detailed expose of this hidden Iran deal giveaway. That's the way Politico put it. President Obama, it says, portrayed the seven men he freed as civilians, quote unquote. The senior official described them as businessmen convicted of or awaiting trial for mere sanctions-related offenses, violations of the trade embargo. I played the three clips there just now for you. Another Obama administration official said that we did not have to release any Iranians involved in terrorism or convicted of violent crimes. The story was that, look, we got the better end of the deal here. Our Americans were sitting there languishing away in prison. And these were just individuals that were convicted of nonviolent crimes. They weren't involved in terrorism. Well, that official said Iran had a significantly higher number of individuals, of course, at the beginning of this negotiation that they would have liked to have seen released, but we were able to winnow that down to these seven individuals, six of whom are Iranian Americans. I mean, they wanted some really hard cases, some really hardened criminals, and we wouldn't allow it. We winnowed it down. Well, here's how Politico sees it. After this investigation, the Obama administration actually granted clemency to seven Iranian-born men convicted or awaiting trial in the United States, including some that Justice Department officials said posed threats to national security. And the administration dropped U.S. charges and international arrest warrants against 14 others, all fugitives. The 14 included some of the most wanted Iranian agents suspected of procuring parts and technology for Tehran's nuclear, ballistics, missiles, and weapons programs. That's what we now know. Now that the details are being revealed about Obama's hidden Iran deal giveaway, that's the title at Politico. Politico here went on to say, in reality, some of them were accused by Obama's own Justice Department of posing threats to national security. Three allegedly were part of an illegal procurement network supplying Iran with U.S.-made microelectronics with applications in surface-to-air and cruise missiles like the kind Tehran test-fired recently, prompting a still-escalating exchange of threats with the Trump administration. It says another was serving an 8-year sentence for conspiring to supply Iran with satellite technology and hardware. As part of the deal, U.S. officials even dropped their demand for $10 million that a jury said the aerospace engineer illegally received from Tehran. We couldn't even get the money back that they owed us. But we were happy to pay them off. A plane load of cash. It had to be in different currencies, of course, because to do it with dollars would have been illegal. So that's how the Obama administration got around it. It says here, regarding one of the individuals that was let go, the Obama administration's decision to grant clemency to 7 men in the U.S. and drop criminal charges and arrest warrants against 14 others overseas undermines strategic enforcement efforts against a broad array of Iranian procurement networks operating in the U.S. that have provided Tehran with a steady stream of critically important parts and technologies for its nuclear and ballistic missile programs and to maintain and expand its military and weapons system. So they were all involved. For the most part, they were all involved in the buildup of Iran's military, its ballistic missiles, and even its nuclear technology. It says here regarding Syed Jamili, a Tehran-based import-export businessman, was charged under seal in Boston in 2013 with conspiring with Chinese associate Sihai Cheng and two Iranian companies to procure thousands of parts with nuclear applications for Iran in a conspiracy dating back to 2005. This is one of the individuals that we gave them, Syed Jamili. Beginning in February 2009, the two allegedly conspired with others to illegally obtain hundreds of specially manufactured pressured transducers believed critical to running Tehran's clandestine nuclear program. They got it out of this company in Massachusetts. It says, although Jamili was the suspected mastermind, Cheng pleaded guilty a month before the swap and is serving a 9-year prison sentence. So he's in jail. Cheng, he's serving a 9-year prison sentence. But the feds backed off of Jamili in late 2014 because that's when these negotiations were coming down to the wire. And so they backed off on all these investigations overseas, trying to capture these individuals, and they were having some success during those years, luring these Iranian spies to international locations where they could be nabbed. And so as part of the nuclear agreement, Iran said to the United States, we want these 7, and we want for you to drop the investigations on those other 14. And as Political brings out, I mean, these were all key players in building up Iran's arsenal. Okay, so they weren't out on the battlefield actually pulling a trigger, but they were building the weapons that the ones pulling the triggers were using. It's pretty amazing. The piece goes on, and again, this is typically a pretty big friend of the Obama administration. But as it points out here, the administration was so obsessed with getting this deal done. I mean, Iran knew it. And so they got everything that they asked for. Bagram Mekanik, I guess is how you pronounce his name. He was charged in Houston, it says, in April 2015, along with two others, for supplying Iran with U.S. origin microelectronics and other commodities, frequently used in a wide range of military systems, including surface, air, and cruise missiles. The men and four U.S. and Iranian companies allegedly sent $24 million worth of commodities to Iran between 2010 and 2015 alone in a conspiracy one Justice Department official described as a clear threat to U.S. national security. This Political piece points out how that so many members of the Justice Department at the Pentagon and wherever were just absolutely outraged because of what the United States gave up in this deal and the many years of intelligence that just went right out the window because of this prisoner swap. My father had a fair bit to say about this. He's written about it as well. I'll get to some of that when we come back from this clip. But this is from his Key of David program last January 28th, 2016, about the, this is just, I presume he recorded this program just a couple of days after that nuclear deal was finalized. Here's what he had to say.
We've had a hostage and a prisoner swap, and now it all happened at the very same time. And of course, it's bringing the emotions of so many people into it because of the prisoners coming home. And of course, everybody's happy about that, but it's sort of overshadowing the horror of this nuclear deal. Look, you can examine this closely, anybody can, and see that something is not right. Something is terribly wrong about this debacle, and you're going to be a part of this terrible world that's coming in the future just before Christ gets here. Was it coincidence that the prisoners were released at the same time that we made the nuclear deal? Well, no, it wasn't. Even if the men who made the deal didn't know it, it wasn't coincidence, because it all is playing into the hands of a very evil spirit that your Bible talks about playing a serious role in this end time. The U.S. released, for our few prisoners, four or five, and they still have two or three they didn't give us, but we released seven economic criminals, they might be called, and 14 others we were trying to extradite to the U.S. for a great crime, some of them treason. And so those are the kinds of criminals we had in our jails here, our prisons.
Yeah, he went on to talk about how that the crimes that those individuals had committed, and how that with respect to the American hostages, I mean, these were just innocents. They hadn't committed any crimes. You talk about lopsided. My father even said, and this is right after the deal was made, he said that one U.S. official said that Iran gave us those prisoners, or rather, that Iran giving us those prisoners was a humanitarian gesture. And then, as I just played for you earlier, I mean, that's the way we presented the swap from our side as well. Well, it's just humanitarian gestures on both sides. Isn't this great? We're all getting along now. But look at what those men were doing. Politico's fully exposed it. And really, my father was exposing it from the get-go. It was all a sham from the start. And then we learned about the piles of cash. What was it, late last summer? A few months on? Right about that time. This is what my father had to say in the Trumpet magazine. This is from October 2016. He said that what happened there in January 16th, January 17th last year, that it's just yet another scandal that you can add to the Obama's growing list of scandals. He talked about the $1.7 billion settlement, the $400 million in foreign currency. My father says here, this was hard to believe, talking about what the truth was early on. But then, as he said, in August, the truth came out. In August, we learned, this actually did happen. First, an interview with one of the hostages, Pastor Saeed Abedini, revealed that, he just described basically that they were on the tarmac there waiting, and they wouldn't be let go until the plane full of cash arrived. Pallets of Swiss francs, euros, and other foreign currencies. And as my father brings out, the U.S. law prevented it from being dollars. And so that's how the Obama administration got around it. And my father says, imagine if a CEO of some major U.S. company operated that way. to just get around the laws, to break the rules. It says now the Iranians are boasting about how the airlifted $400 million was the ransom money for four Americans. I mean, they got seven prisoners in exchange, 14 others that we dropped charges on, and then all this cash. And no wonder they were boasting. It says U.S. officials acknowledge that Iranian negotiators on the prisoner exchange said they wanted the cash to show they had gained something tangible. That's from the Wall Street Journal last year. My father went on to say here, the U.S. government has had a no-ransom policy in the past. The Obama administration insisted this was not a ransom payment. But then a couple weeks later, it admitted that it delivered the cash only if and when Iran released the prisoners. How can we consider ourselves a superpower when we make such a ridiculous deal, my father asked. How can you explain America now being the number one state sponsor of the number one state sponsor of terrorism? It's a good way to put it. Here, Iran's the number one state sponsor of terror, and we're sponsoring them. We're funding them. We're helping them. Well, there's a new administration in the White House now, and they're, as they said last week, they're reviewing this deal, but it's not a good sign when that administration comes out and says, well, Iran's, you know, pretty much complying with the rules of the deal. Now, they came out with some stronger criticism aimed at Iran, I think, the day after they made that statement. But still, this was the first, my father said this was the worst foreign policy blunder in American history, something to that effect. And now we're seeing just how bad it was. And listen, I mean, it's not over, this story. We're going to learn more. But worse than that, they're building up this military, this arsenal, firing off ballistic missiles, gathering the technology that they're going to need for nukes. And it's happening all over the world. Just to close the loop on what we talked about in the first segment, it's happening everywhere in the world, every nation, it seems. I mean, they're arming for war. But in the United States, in Great Britain, it's a different story. Our militaries are in decline. We have an aging arsenal. Now, you put all of this together with the prophecies. Matthew 24, as I said in the last segment, what it says in Revelation 12. My father actually referred to Revelation 12, 9 and verse 12, I think, as well, in that Key of David program that I just played a clip from. Let me just read to you what it says in Revelation 12, verse 9. It says, and the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. So they've been cast down, and now they're confined to this earth. And now, I mean, the heavens are rejoicing. It says in verse 12, woe unto the inhabitants of the earth, though, and the sea, for the devil's come down to you, it says, having great wrath, because he knows that he has but a short time. Satan is well aware of how short time is. And as my father's pointed out so many times before, I mean, if he's aware of how short time is, we better be aware. We better be aware. We better be on guard and vigilant. Because he's going about, Satan is, as a roaring lion, like Peter wrote. And he's just devouring people. And we've seen so much destruction in the church. We've seen so many of God's people destroyed in these last days. We've seen a worldwide work just absolutely devastated because of Satan's wrath. And now we're about to see it come upon our nations as well. Physical destruction, warfare, bloodshed, strife. There's a parallel there. We can follow. We can see what's happened in the spiritual sense. All of this destruction, an abomination of desolation. And we can certainly see what it's building toward among the nations. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
On yesterday's program, I ran out of time with this particular story that I wanted to get to. Britain's empire was a matter of pride, not guilt, as we Indians know. As I mentioned yesterday, this piece at the Telegraph, written by an Indian in response to so many of the revisionist historians trying to say that everything associated with the empire just brought evil into this world. He says here, the Queen's 91st birthday last Friday was an opportunity to reflect upon her reign and to replay those famous photos of her returning in 1952 from what was then the colony and protectorate of Kenya to ascend to the throne. The sun was already setting on Her Majesty's empire, and many thought that was no bad thing. Many were applauding it. He says, today in Britain, the word empire always seems to be preceded by the word evil. With politically correct media and academia glibly assuming that those large swaths of the map that were once painted pink endured unmitigated political oppression and economic exploitation. He says, as an Indian historian, I'm bemused by this masochistic glee. With Britain preparing to rebuild trade links with its former empire post-Brexit, does it really need to apologize for its imperial past? Or could it take new pride in what it did to modernize and democratize the world? We had a couple of programs. I don't think it was last year. I think it was the year before when we first got over here to Edstone, just talking about some of this history and how that it should be a point of pride. He says here, many Britons are ready to swallow the most outrageous allegations about their country's colonial past. I mean, it's bad enough that this is what the enemies say, but that many Britons would swallow these outrageous allegations, that's what's shocking. A particularly egregious example is the recent claim by the Indian polemicist Shashi Tharoor in his book Inglorious Empire that Winston Churchill had more blood on his hands than Hitler. That's in a book, and people are probably raving about it. Inglorious Empire. Oh, I like that title as well. The factual basis for the genocide charge against Churchill was his reluctance to, well, I don't even get into all these details. It's ridiculous on its face. But he says here, it's just hard for me to understand why the British. He's writing as an Indian, and he can't understand why the British are so eager to just take the blame for everything. It says only a century ago, empire was the default mode of governance across the globe, based on the assumption that larger states with diverse populations and geography and free trade We're likely to be richer and more successful. It says, of course, the British Empire existed primarily for the benefit of Britain, but its incidental benefits for subject nations could be considerable. To dismiss those as being unintended is like denying the benefits of capitalism because it's motivated by private profit. Well, there were benefits, but that's incidental. It certainly wasn't because of the Brits. They were evil. It was an inglorious empire. It says the most widely propagated fallacy about British imperial exploitation is the notion that India's steep decline as the world's leading textile exporter from the 18th century to the 19th was due to a deliberate policy of deindustrialization by the British. So that's what's popular. That's the fallacy that so many have embraced. It's Britain's fault. It's the empire's fault. It's the fault of the inglorious empire. It says many thousands of British personnel in India had a sincere commitment to those they governed, especially in the elite Indian civil service, dubbed heaven-born for its incorruptibility. Recruited by competitive open examination, the ICS was far ahead of its domestic British counterpart, attracting the best brains in Britain and India. It says, just a couple more comments here, by the time of independence, most of the ICS had been Indianized, like the judiciary and the army. That demonstrates that demographic reality, that the Raj throughout was more Indian than British. There was no way a few thousand Britons could have ruled a subcontinent of 300 million for a century and a half without the active cooperation of the vast majority of Indians. That's what they had, this author says. Most of them rather liked the way that the Brits ruled. That's what he's saying. Here you had a few thousand Britons ruling over a subcontinent of 300 million for a century. That's a collective memory that has faded 70 years on, with hardly any survivors, British or Indian, who have had direct experience of the Raj, that's British rule in India. Historical amnesia is a fertile breeding ground for both the post-colonial guilt of the British liberal left and the anti-imperialist myths of Indian chauvinists. That's coming from, as I say, an Indian author writing at The Telegraph just a couple of days ago. Well, I had a few other scriptures that I might, or that I would have turned to. But rather than that, I think I'll conclude a few minutes early as I've got another speaking engagement here at the top of the hour. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program if you like. You can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.